NPR's interview with Jason Kessler, organizer of the Unite the Right rally, sparked widespread criticism for giving white supremacists a platform. How should media outlets cover white supremacists and white nationalist groups? How have they covered these groups since the deadly rally in Charlottesville last year?
Joining me to talk about the interview and media coverage of white supremacists is Will Sommer, a tech reporter for the Daily Beast. Will also publishes a weekly newsletter about conservative media called The Right Richter. And Will joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Will. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Will, you covered last weekend's rally, so we'll ask you about that. But before we do, as always on our media roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out. So what caught your attention this week?
Oh, gosh. You know, I hate to give a plug for my own publication, but I got to give a shout-out to a recent Daily Beast story about that President Trump derailing a meeting with Vietnam veterans with an argument about Apocalypse Now. And he kept insisting they had gotten a scene. They were misremembering a scene from it. So just kind of another bizarre scene from the Trump presidency.
What happened exactly?
Yeah, so they wanted more... They wanted aid for Vietnam veterans who were exposed to Agent Orange. And he said, well, oh, isn't that the stuff from Apocalypse Now? In that case, it would be napalm. And they said, no, that's not the case. And he said, you know, he got in this big argument with them about this movie.
Wow. I had not heard about that one. I have
heard
a lot about the military parade that has been canceled. That's
mentioned.
But I'm glad you brought this up, Will, because a couple of journalists are saying, isn't it interesting that the military parade is getting widespread media attention, but the $717 billion military bill, which overwhelmingly passed the House and the Senate, is really not getting much attention at all?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's kind of a classic thing is that, you know, I mean, there's a reason we have such a gargantuan military budget. And it's that, you know, there's very little oversight in terms of, you know, saying, oh, maybe we don't want to spend this much on the military.
Right. And we should point out that 10 senators voted against it, including people like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris. Cory Booker did vote for it. I feel like I bang my head on the wall about this issue for years since I've been hosting this show. We always ask journalists, you know, why don't these bills get more scrutiny? We just did a show about veterans' health care, and this military massive spending bill does not include veterans' health care. So much of this is weapons, nuclear weapons. Why don't you think these bills get more scrutiny, especially when we're talking about $1,717 billion?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a great question. I think, I think there's a general hawkishness in Congress, and I think, you know, obviously it's such a huge amount of money to dig into.
Well, let's dive in now, Will, and talk about how the media are covering and how they should cover white supremacists. You covered last weekend's Unite the Right rally, and as you know, there's been a lot of debate and criticism over NPR's Noelle King's interview with Jason Kessler. Overall, what are your thoughts about that interview, NPR interviewing someone like Jason Kessler?
Sure. I think the sort of the core of the controversy about that interview is how they gave Jason Kessler a platform essentially to push his ideas specifically. And so they said there was one point where essentially he was ranking the different races of people as he saw them. I mean, that's a bizarre thing for NPR to give a platform for. It's really unclear why, they decided to do that. I think, you know, at the same time, in defense of NPR at this interview, I think the journalistic mores around how to cover white supremacists, I think, have really changed even in the past couple of years as this has become sort of a more pressing issue. I mean, certainly I think if this was 2014 and they had done that, I don't think there really would have been much of an outcry.
Yeah, I think you're right about ranking people based on race. I was really shocked that she actually asked him to rank people and that she gave him time to answer that question. The other thing that really struck me about it is that Jason Kessler, last year after Heather Heyer was killed by a white supremacist who rammed his car into a crowd, Jason Kessler actually tweeted, and I mean, this is very insulting. Heather Heyer was a fat,
disgusting communist. Communists have killed 94 million. Looks like it was payback time. And she didn't ask him about that.
Yeah, I think the other thing that kind of has to be taken into account with this is it's a beat that really I think requires and it's sort of a responsibility on the reporters to be very well versed in who they're talking to, because otherwise you end up with something like this where you say sort of like, oh, Jason Kessler, like, you know, and kind of let him control the interview rather than bringing up kind of these hard the hard questions. You know, if you're going to interview him, you know, ask him about this kind of the vile stuff he said, and don't let him sort of avoid taking responsibility.
Hello, Will, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm here. Hey there.
Hey, Will, sorry about that. You are definitely still on the air, and we're
going
to try to figure out a way so that you and Rose can hear each other. I'm not sure if you are able to respond to her last question.
So, God, can you remind me what it is?
She was asking about the coverage around Heather Heyer.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I think there's a responsibility on reporters to, come to this versed in the topic if you are going to interview people like this, because I think it is, potentially a very risky endeavor. And so I think you need to be able to be experienced enough in who you're talking to that you don't let them sort of control the interview.
All right. Thanks. And we should have Rose back now. Rose, are you there?
I'm here. I'm really sorry. I'm hosting from KRCB in Northern California, and once again, we're having technical problems. Hello? Am I still there?
You're there, yeah. Rose. We can hear you.
Okay, thank you. Sorry about that, Will. You know, Will, let's talk about the bigger picture here, because we had on A.C. Thompson last week, and he worked on a Frontline documentary about a number of these white supremacist groups. He has interviewed them. He has done extensive research. And he said that, you know, it's clear based on the group's actions. It's clear based on the interviews that he's done with them. These are violent groups. They train to fight, and they go to rallies. They go city to city, sometimes the same people, to actually hurt people. And the violence also wasn't brought up in that NPR interview. But, I mean, this is very serious, right? We're not just talking about people carrying tiki torches, which, you know, saying Jews will not replace us is horrific in and of itself, but the fact is these people go from town to town to fight and hurt people. That is a fact. Do you think the media are doing a good enough job of raising that important point and talking about that?
No, I don't think so. I think A.C. Thompson's work on this has been very valuable, and I think that it's absolutely, I think a lot of these groups are able to hide behind this idea of, oh, you know, this is sort of a free speech thing, when in fact, the violence, as you said, is a very integral part of it, and that they are essentially looking for that. Now, in the case of Unite the Right, too, I mean, they couldn't do that because there were so few of them compared to the people who, on the other side, who wanted to fight them. So that wouldn't have worked. But in these other cases, things we see in smaller towns, that is certainly an issue.
The other thing that you said, Will, is that these groups in Charlottesville, they're now kind of fracturing in three different groups. Some of them are planning to still do these kinds of rallies. Others want to do flash mobs where they don't get up. And others are going to go underground and take part in terrorist activity.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. There are, the whole alt-right scene, as we know, it is very fractured. As you mentioned, there are still some people committed to this idea of public rallies and displays. On the other hand, I think some of the savvier operators have said, well, you know, what we need to do is just sort of kind of go underground for a bit, or try to sort of integrate ourselves into more mainstream Republican politics and see if we can kind of try to shift the party in the direction we want it from there. And then on the other hand, as you say, there is a splinter faction that is often discussing and contemplating violent action.
Today we're speaking with Will Sommer, a tech reporter, a weekly newsletter about conservative media called The Right. Will, can you talk a little bit more about the violent aspects of this, how you think the media should bring this in?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think, as I said, I think a lot of people are following the idea that, these are just kind of people expressing nonviolent but horrendous views, or, they fall for this idea of, for example, Richard Spencer talked about, sort of peaceful ethnic cleansing. Well, of course, in reality, there's no such thing. I also think, additionally, the sort of the violent elements, whether it be a group like the Proud Boys, or which are perhaps a more moderate in terms of their racial views, or the Fraternal Order of Alt Knights, or these various groups, or the Rise Above movement in California, these groups that are essentially street fighting organizations, very specifically, and devote a lot of time to almost paramilitary-esque training.
Well, if you guys join us, if you heard the NPR interview with Jason Kessler, or if you'd like to talk more generally about how the media have covered these white supremacist groups and white nationalists, how you think they should cover them moving forward, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you saw that Frontline documentary, really incredible, looking at all facets of these, who they are, where they come from, what is their end game? The fact that they do train to fight, and when the same people travel from city to city, to really hurt people, take each other's fire. She was killed by a white supremacist who rammed his car into a group. We'd love to hear from you. I want to also ask Will about the Trump administration and the role that they play in all of this. I mean, of course, Trump started his political campaign on the national stage by calling Barack Obama, a birther. He started that so-called birther movement, saying he wasn't born in the United States. And A.C. Thompson, in the documentary, interviewed a number of white nationalists who said they were completely emboldened by Donald Trump. They said before Donald Trump, they were underground, they were on the fringes, and he opened the door for them. Do you think that the media are talking about that aspect of this story?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, there's no question that white supremacists and the alt-right and these various sort of shades of white racism, they feel emboldened in the Trump administration. As you said, the president himself obviously was a huge promoter of the racist birther conspiracy theory. I would say that's a big element of it. And of course, the fact that the president himself has been very sort of waffly on denouncing the violence in Charlottesville, saying, well, good people on both sides and stuff like that. I mean, that is taken by white supremacists, whether it's meant that way or not, and that is taken as a sort of as a tacit approval from the president.
And as a journalist who covers these issues, Will, what angles are you looking at this point?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in terms of the fracturing of the alt-right, as you say. The Unite the Right was so small the second time around, in part because so many of these groups have disowned the organizer, Jason Kessler. Either they're favoring different tactics or they accuse him of being, a spy for the federal government or whatever, which I should say is a pretty baseless accusation, or they think he's, just kind of an unstable guy. On the other hand, I think there's also some very interesting interplay between these racist groups and, militia groups or the believers in the QAnon conspiracy theory. They're just kind of like they all meet in certain online locations, online forums that they have in common, and these ideas kind of intermingle.
We have an email from David who says, I'm sure that right-wingers flooded the networks with complaints when my email just crashed. We're having some technical issues here. Let me ask you about what Mike reporter Chauncey Alcorn wrote. He also covered the rally, and he wrote, "The alt-right may not have shown up in force in D.C. on Sunday the way they did in Charlottesville a year ago, but if you read and listen to their leaders, as I do regularly, you'll realize most of them can't stand Jason Kessler, and many of them don't think Nazi rallies are the way to go right now, especially after what happened to them a year ago. Meanwhile, Fox News, is echoing alt-right talking points to their millions of virtually all-white viewers every night. The alt-right and the rising racial cultural tensions stemming from the Black Lives Matter movement and Me Too has shifted conservative America's window to such a degree that they're spouting white nationalist views." What are your thoughts on that, Will?
Sure. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, first of all, I would say that the sort of lackluster turnout in D.C. For the Unite the Right 2 should not be seen, entirely as a sign that the alt-right is in chaos. On the other hand, I do think the far bigger issue is the sort of mainlining of white nationalist or sort of pseudo-white nationalist rhetoric in the mainstream Republican Party and in right-wing media. So, for example, Laura Ingraham and Tucker Carlson recently have been doing these, who are, of course, Fox News hosts and gigantic stars in conservative media, have been doing these segments that have a lot of shades of what we would think of as white nationalist rhetoric. And so they say things like, for example, the problem is also illegal immigration, or they say, they'll specifically criticize, where immigrants are coming from. And so, this idea of white people being replaced or the country losing its sort of white character or whatever, that is not very far from what, for example, David Duke might say. And so, I think the larger issue is this sort of is not, Nazi groups marching in the streets, but it is sort of the mainlining of this rhetoric into the Republican Party.
Exactly. And you publish a weekly newsletter about conservative media called The Right Richter. How are you seeing white supremacist ideology move into more mainstream media outlets? Not just
sure,
Fox,
absolutely.
But, various cable shows, let's say CNN, for example. What are you seeing out there?
Sure, absolutely. So, it is a lot of stuff like Fox News and, the promotion of, say, very hardline anti-immigration groups that, of course, decades now, the conservative complaint has ostensibly been with illegal immigration. But now, more and more, they're saying, it's also legal immigration, and the Trump administration is trying to go back and reverse naturalizations or that they claim are fraudulent and stuff like that. So, yeah, I would say that's absolutely the larger issue at play.
And what about more of the ideologies moving into the mainstream? Do you think, let's just put this out there, do you think that reporters are comfortable really calling this for what it is? Because as A.C. Thompson reported, these guys are going from city to city to fight and incite violence, and we're getting so much of this rhetoric directly from the White House. And in the name of, quote, balance, sometimes you just don't get the real story. It's like, well, we talked to Jason Kessler, and then we're bringing someone on from Black Lives Matter, which is what Noelle King did, and that got a lot of criticism.
Sure, absolutely. I think the press is getting better at it, but I think that there is a reluctance to call something racist or call something white supremacist. We saw the Unite the Right rally the second one, getting called described as what its organizers wanted, which is a white civil rights rally. Of course, that's not really what's at play, but, you end up with things like, for example, things are described as racially tinged or stuff like that rather than explicitly racist. And I think in the Trump era, this has become a much sort of more pressing issue. At the same time, as you mentioned, I think there's a lot of false equivalence going on in terms of, we're going to have this white supremacist on, and then we're going to have a Black Lives Matter activist. The idea that these are, two equally respectable poles, or, these ideas with a similar level of acceptance, I think, is a trap the media can fall into.
Will Sommer is a tech reporter for The Daily Beast. He also publishes a weekly newsletter about conservative media called The Right Richter. And we've got about 5 or so minutes left with Will. If you have any comments about how you think the media should cover white supremacists, racism, hate crimes, the connections are there. The connections are deep. Do you think that the media are making them? Where are you seeing those connections? Because we're having some technical problems, it might be better if you email, and my computer's back up, so I'll definitely get your emails, yourcall@kalw.org. Will, can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So what about the connections, Will, between the hate crimes that we're seeing, you know, people, white people calling the police on black people, people of color, now that we have video, this is happening probably once or more a week. What about the connections there?
Sure. You know, I think that the, you know, one thing I think that's going on is I think as conservative media has become more, I think, racially tinged or racially aware in the past couple of years, there has been, for example, like on Breitbart, you know, of course, Breitbart had a whole section called Black Crime once, you know, they've done away with it. But there was sort of this, they would promote stories that were about just crimes committed by black people, and that were sort of not particularly newsworthy crimes, but they would just promote them, and this creates kind of a racial panic. And so then I think the way this plays out is in, you know, for example, you know, white people calling the police on black people who aren't really doing anything, and just kind of this this paranoia that I think is a result of a lot of this sort of breathless crime reporting.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and I just want to apologize and thank you for bearing with us dealing with all of these technical issues. We will definitely get this fixed and make sure that this does not happen in the future. Now we are going to turn to the stunning verdict ordering Monsanto to pay $289 million in damages to a man dying of cancer from exposure to the company's herbicides. 46-year-old father Dwayne Johnson developed a severe and fatal form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma while working as a school groundskeeper in Benicia, California. As part of his job, he was responsible for spraying large quantities of Monsanto's Roundup and other herbicide brands, upwards of 150 gallons per day. He had perfect skin before he started spraying the herbicide on school grounds, according to his lawyers. And then he began developing tumors on his skin. He is not expected to live past the year 2020. Of course, this is getting so much media attention because it is a massive verdict. Monsanto has been ordered to pay $289 million in damages to a man dying from cancer. And we will soon be joined by Carrie Gillum. She is a journalist, author, and public interest researcher for the organization U.S. Right to Know. It's a nonprofit food industry research group, and she's also author of the book Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. It was awarded the Rachel Carson Book Awarded by the Society of Environmental Journalists. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about this lawsuit, and if you'd like to talk about how the media cover Monsanto, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email from Carl. He says, I really look forward to the show. Sorry about the technical issues. The discussion of the Monsanto case, I have had discussions with people who categorically deny that there's any evidence of a link between glyphosate and cancer. I'm having a hard time gleaning from the news accounts any details of the evidence presented by the defense that there are such links, which makes it hard to assess the pro and the con arguments. It would be great if your guest could provide any information that might help with that. And yeah, Carl, that is a question that we are definitely going to ask Carrie about. A number of organizations are asking about whether or not the science was brought into the court case. What exactly did the jury base their decision on? And we'll be asking Carrie Gillum that question. She's a journalist, author, and public interest researcher with U.S. Right to Know. And Carrie is joining us from Australia, and we are going to get her on the line in just a minute. Let me just read from the Guardian piece while we get Carrie on the line. Johnson's lawyers, Dwayne Johnson, the 46-year-old former groundskeeper, argued that over the course of a month-long trial, Monsanto had, quote, fought science for years and targeted academics who spoke up about possible health risks of the herbicide. Johnson was the first person to take Monsanto to trial over allegations that the chemical sold under the brand Roundup causes cancer. In the extraordinary verdict, which Monsanto said it intends to appeal, the jury ruled that the company was responsible for negligent failure and knew or should have known that its product was dangerous. Now I would like to welcome Carrie Gillen to the show. Hi, Carrie. Welcome to the show.
Well, hi there. Sorry about all the trouble.
Oh, yeah. Well, live radio. Hopefully this won't happen again. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Carrie, let's get to the crux of the matter, because there's a lot of questions about whether the science was brought into the courtroom. What were the main arguments?
All right. So this trial lasted, you know, for nearly a month, and it was very heavy with science. The jurors really had to sit through a lot of epidemiology and toxicology data. And it got very specific, both with Monsanto's own expert scientific witnesses and the plaintiff's own scientific experts, who laid it all out for them. They walked through, you know, things that most people would never even hear about in terms of very specific and technical data. And of course, you know, that was one part of the trial. The other part of the evidence that was laid out was the documents that show how hard Monsanto has worked to suppress this scientific evidence over the years. So it was really twofold. But in regards to the question from your listener, there are a number of studies. I write about them in my book. The International Agency for Research on Cancer based its classification of glyphosate as a probable human carcinogen on the studies, the data that's out there. Monsanto has maintained that all of these other, these studies and this research that shows a link to cancer is not valid. They say that this is junk science, and they say that the studies that they have funded and that they have backed and that they have worked on are really the only studies that are valid and the only studies that people should consider when looking at safety.
So let's take a step back and talk about this case. Let's start with Dwayne Johnson's story. Tell us a bit about Dwayne Johnson. He is a 46-year-old. He is not expected to live past 2020. Tell us more about him.
Right. Yeah. Well, you did a good job there. He's got two young sons. He's married, has two young sons. He has an older son from a prior relationship. In 2012, he started work for the Benicia School District, trying to trap and track, pests and varmints, and also trying to keep the grounds clean and cleared of weeds. And so part of his job was to spray Roundup, routinely. And he did that in large quantities, as you mentioned. He had a couple of incidents where the equipment malfunctioned and he was doused in the weed killer. One of the products that he was using is called Ranger Pro. It's another glyphosate-based herbicide, and it's a more toxic formulation. So, you know, he was doused in these chemicals, and then it was, you know, several months later when he started to develop these lesions on his skin, and they worsened, and as you said, went into turned into this fatal form of mycosis fungoides, which is a type of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and it's invaded his body. His doctors actually didn't expect him to live to see the trial, but he went into remission around November of last year and is doing better, although he's starting another round of chemotherapy right now.
And I understand, according to reports, one of the first things Dwayne did was call Monsanto to find out what was in Roundup. He was wondering, what is in this stuff?
Yeah, according to the testimony, he was concerned because he was aware, you know, these are toxic chemicals, clearly. You know, they're designed to kill living things, plants. So he reached out to Monsanto to ask about, any risks that he should be aware of. And you can see in the internal memos from Monsanto that there was discussion about his call and his concern, but they basically, you know, the first person who took the call didn't give him very much information, and then the scientist who was supposed to call him back never did. And then he had reached out to another number a second time and still really got no information. So he maintained that had he been warned, had he been told that, you know, yes, this is a probable human carcinogen, at least by the standards of the International Agency for Research on Cancer, that he may have, stopped spraying it or changed his practices. But because he wasn't warned, he kept on using it, even after he developed these skin lesions.
We touched on this a bit, but let's talk more about the testimony and the evidence presented at the trial and what it reveals about Monsanto's own scientific research and how the company then responded to that research. In The Guardian, you write, testimony and evidence presented at trial show that the warning signs seen in scientific research dated back to the early 80s and have only increased over the decades. But with each new study showing harm, Monsanto worked not to warn users or redesign its products, but to create its own science to show they were safe. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So in 1983, there was a very robust toxicology study. It was a mouse study, mice that had been dosed with glyphosate. And Monsanto actually paid for the study and submitted it to the EPA. Unfortunately for Monsanto, all of the mice who did not receive a dose of glyphosate, who were not treated, none of them developed tumors. But mice who were treated with glyphosate, some of them developed these rare kidney tumors. And so the toxicologist at the EPA, when they analyzed the data in a more thorough way, of course, I'm just giving you the top line here, but they were concerned, and they said, this looks like it could cause cancer. This looks like this chemical is possibly carcinogenic. Monsanto, fought back against that and told them they were wrong. The EPA toxicologist said they weren't wrong, and it wasn't their job to protect Monsanto, and thus began what turned out to be a several years long sort of debate back and forth between Monsanto and the EPA toxicologist. Monsanto was asked to redo the study. It refused, and brought in its own scientist, who Monsanto decided was going to, find a tumor basically in the control group, which would change the statistical relevance of these tumors that had been found in the dosed group. And lo and behold, this scientific expert that Monsanto paid and brought in did find that exact. He found a tumor in the control group and convinced the EPA to disregard its own toxicologist recommendations. And so dating back to the 80s, you saw this reluctance to really take heed of evidence of cancer risk. And then, it went on. There was a genotoxicity issues that developed in the 1990s. Again, a consultant that Monsanto hired raised concerns and said, this looks like we need to do some more study. Monsanto didn't want to do that. They talk internally in their communications about needing to find somebody else who's going to have a more positive feeling about their chemical. There are many examples throughout the years of Monsanto turning away from any concern or any evidence of risk.
On today's Media Roundtable, we're speaking with Carrie Gillum, a journalist, a public interest researcher for the U.S. Right to Know. It's a nonprofit food industry research group. She's also the author of Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. Carrie, how long have you been covering Monsanto?
Since 1998.
A very long time. Can you talk about the importance of really understanding the science from a journalist's perspective in order to adequately cover an important trial like this? Because, if I were to go and cover this trial, you cover the trial, but you really have to do extensive reading to learn about Monsanto, to learn about the history of Monsanto, to learn about the science, the relationship between the EPA and Monsanto. I mean, you really need some context to cover this issue adequately, right?
Well, certainly. I feel that way, of course, because I have been steeped in this for 20 years. I feel like I have that context and that perspective, and I think it would be hard for someone just coming at this cold. And the trial, there was so much evidence that actually was excluded that the jurors were not allowed to hear about. They were not allowed to hear about fraud that took place in the 1970s on chemical registration review studies that were being put together, and that a former Monsanto scientist was involved and went to prison for fraud. They were not allowed to hear about state of California's assessment and desire to put warning labels on Roundup products. There was a lot of information that was left out for the jurors, but they, even without that context, were able to weigh both sides and really come up with what was a very powerful statement. In their award, $250 million of the $289 million was punitive damages. And the punitive damages, the way that they were awarded and they were described, was that there was clear and convincing evidence that Monsanto acted with malice or oppression. And the definition of that was given as conduct that was particularly despicable or vile. They really found that Monsanto had acted, you know, with a disregard for public health. You know, and I only gave you a couple of examples. There are others that in the 2015, the ATSDR, which is part of our Health and Human Services, wanted to do a toxicity review of glyphosate, and Monsanto did not want them to do that, and talks in their documents about they don't want them to do that. And so what they did is they went to some friendly EPA officials and enlisted their assistance in making that review go away, and it did. When the International Agency for Research on Cancer was going to start looking at glyphosate before they even did their review, but when it was announced that they were going to do their review, Monsanto, you can see again in their internal memos, Monsanto started working on a plan to discredit the agency. And they said they knew they were vulnerable. They knew the science of the epidemiology and the toxicology made them vulnerable to a cancer classification, and so they started working on a plan to discredit this agency even before the agency met. Those kinds of things resonated with the jurors.
Carrie, how do you think the national media cover companies like Monsanto? You have in the past criticized your former employer, Reuters, and the way that they covered Monsanto's Roundup.
Not all coverage. There were two stories in particular that were handled very, very poorly by a former colleague, and I mean so just egregiously falsely that they had to be called out. But you know, otherwise, the national media, I think they've done a fairly good job. It's hard for someone, again, if you don't cover this on a daily basis and you haven't done it for a decade or two decades, because you know, the company is so strong in its messaging and has so many allies who are powerful and have a lot of money, and they push out this messaging through third parties, through front groups, through lobbying organizations. We've seen evidence in the documents of all of the different ways that Monsanto has what they call ghostwritten. It's not just in the scientific literature. They're writing policy briefs. They're writing papers that are appearing on websites under someone else's name, someone who looks like an independent academic. You know, we have science policy groups that are supposedly independent that we know were funded and set up by Monsanto specifically to target and harass certain scientists. We know all this because of these internal documents that have come out. If you don't know that, you don't have those internal documents, certainly you're going to, you know, think that maybe what Monsanto is telling you is true.
Well, how do you think the media deal with, for example, like the Environmental Working Group will come out and say, put out a report about chemicals, and then you'll have another group saying the Environmental Working Group is peddling false information and scare tactics? How do you think reporters, or how are reporters dealing with that, and how should they?
Well, you know, a lot of them have been calling me. I think you're talking about this Environmental Working Group report on the weed killer found in oatmeal, glyphosate found in oatmeal, is the most recent example. But, I mean, there's so many nuances in all of this. You know, I reported 2 years ago that FDA had found glyphosate in oatmeal. It's definitely, the residues of the herbicide definitely are in a wide variety of foods that we consume on a regular basis. The question and debate is around now, what levels do we need to worry about? You know, what levels of these residues do we need to worry about? And that science is really still evolving. And, you know, some scientists at Harvard and UCSF and others say that the levels that we previously or have assumed to be safe, that our EPA tells us we don't have to worry about, that science tells us now that we should, and that even very low levels can be particularly damaging to vulnerable populations such as young children. But that, you know, there are other scientists who say, no, we're fine with residues, pesticide residues in our foods. So, you know, you have to look at that, and I think you have to take a balanced view and approach. It's worth noting, if we're talking about pesticides in our foods, you know, we rely on the EPA to tell us what levels are safe. Well, they told us for many years that levels of the insecticide chlorpyrifos were safe in our food. This is the one sold by Dow Chemical. A couple of years ago, they kind of essentially said, oops, actually no levels. We can't say that any levels are safe in our food. And yet the most recent FDA report tells us that this particular insecticide is the fourth most prevalent type of pesticide found in our food. So, you know, the assurances of safety certainly are not very reassuring.
Well, and what do you think citizens should do with this kind of information? Because as you point out, the Environmental Working Group says glyphosate has been found in a number of foods, including Cheerios and Quaker Oats, General Mills and Quaker Oats. And then you get groups saying that they're it's junk science. So as a citizen, what do you do?
Well, it's definitely not junk science that it's in our food. It is in our food. We have an array of insecticides, herbicides, and fungicides that are commonly found in our food. That's documented in annual reports filed by USDA and FDA, as well as a number of academics and consumer groups around the world. So we know that. We know that glyphosate has been similarly documented. So the issue is, how much do we worry about that? And that's at this point, as the science evolves, you know, consumers, what they need to do is really just arm themselves with information and decide for themselves how worried they are about pesticide residues in our foods. I'm researching that. Others are researching it. And consumers would be wise to arm themselves with information as well.
We have an email from Ian who says, the larger problem of Monsanto is that it's a for-profit company. Monsanto and other companies are responsible for the profiteering of poor farmers around the world, contributing to our impending ecological collapse, while stifling responsible farming practices. How do you think this ruling will affect Monsanto's, you know, it's in so many different parts of our society. It affects so many people. It affects the environment. How will it affect a larger corporation?
That's a really good question. A lot of people are looking for an answer right now. So Monsanto, of course, was acquired by Bayer in June. They closed on that deal. So it's now part of a German company. And Monsanto's glyphosate sales are directly relevant to its genetically engineered seed sales. And all of this, of course, is a big reason why Bayer bought Monsanto, because of the control it has over both the seed supply and its prominent role in these herbicide sales. So, but what we're seeing is with this ruling that, you know, investors in Bayer are very nervous. The shares plummeted after the ruling. Retailers in Europe are looking at pulling glyphosate from their shelves. Different countries in Europe are now talking about bans or restrictions. They're in Brazil, we have a federal judge who is saying there should be no new uses of glyphosate, and glyphosate use should be suspended. So it really is resonating around the world, and people are taking a harder look at Monsanto and what they've been doing with glyphosate and how it impacts, as your caller discussed, how it impacts farming around the world.
You brought up a number of points there. Kathy called in and wanted you to talk about the significance of Bayer buying Monsanto. And Reuters has a piece just from yesterday that says Bayer can begin folding Monsanto into its organization as the antitrust-related sale of assets has been completed.
Right. Bayer, so they closed on the purchase in June, but it's been separate. It's been operating still independently and considered a wholly owned subsidiary. But Bayer announced yesterday that it could continue with the integration. And it noted, the Bayer officials noted, that they now could bring, you know, their own firepower to fight these lawsuits and to try to win an appeal. You know, Monsanto has said that it will appeal this Johnson verdict. So Bayer is going to bring the big guns now to Monsanto's aid.
And in response to the verdict, as you said, Monsanto is going to appeal. It also says, quote, glyphosate does not cause cancer. We will continue to stand by the science and vigorously defend glyphosate. What do you think are the implications of this case? And there are so many more lawsuits against Monsanto for their use of glyphosate. This is just the first one.
Yeah, there are 4,000 to 5,000 additional plaintiffs who have already filed lawsuits around the United States. They all allege that they developed non-Hodgkin lymphoma because of exposure to Monsanto's products, and they all allege that Monsanto has known about the risks and hidden the risks. You know, so this large jury verdict, if it is upheld on appeal, certainly, you know, sets the tone for perhaps what could be not just hundreds of millions of dollars in damages, but billions of dollars in damages against Monsanto. And that could really send a shockwave around the world if these lawsuits continue to snowball and large damage awards continue, you know, to come down.
And Dwayne Johnson is young. He's only 46 years old. As you said, he has two children. He and his wife, Araceli Johnson, have two children. Araceli is a nurse practitioner. According to reports, she's now working 14 hours a day at two jobs just to pay the bills. Have you interviewed Dwayne, Carrie?
No, the lawyers have not let me interview him. I've interviewed several other plaintiffs, but haven't been able to get to Johnson yet.
Wow, it's just such a sad story, and I saw photos of the lesions on his skin.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty horrific when you look at how the cancer has ravaged his body and just really taken such a hard effect on his family. His wife wasn't even able to be there for the verdict because she was working.
Wow. $289 million, this is a damage verdict. Do you think that Monsanto executives will ever be held accountable for this? Do you think it'll ever get to that point?
You know, it sure doesn't seem like we do that in this country. I mean, you know, we have other examples in other industries of big corporations, pushing deadly chemicals, to consumers. I mean, you saw it with DuPont. DuPont had a similar situation and paid out hundreds of millions of dollars for knowingly poisoning, you know, city drinking water. They don't go to jail. We don't do that. We seem to worship wealth and profit and power in this country, and it puts public health at risk. I think that needs to change, but that's not where we are yet.
Well, you're definitely doing that with your work, Carrie. What aspect of this story do you plan to cover next?
Well, I really am following the research that's evolving on the MRLs, or what we refer to as the pesticide residue levels in our food, and what is safe and what isn't, because we're all eating it every day. That's not in dispute. So we just need to know what it's doing to our health. And we do know that disease and ailment and cancer rates have been rising in the United States, and we know that our food is pretty poisoned. So just trying to do more research on that.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for all your work, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Carrie Gillum is a journalist and a public interest researcher for the organization U.S. Right to Know. It's a nonprofit food industry research group. She's also author of the book Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. And if you want to learn more about Monsanto, there's an incredible documentary called The World According to Monsanto. You can find it online for free. And then find more about Carrie and her work at yourcallradio.org. Your Call is produced here at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can leave us a review. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio. Email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thank you, and thanks to Laura Flynn for producing today's show. Thanks to Luis Hernandez, who is our intern. They did a lot of work behind the scenes today. And again, I'm sorry about the technical issues. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. We'll be right back.